Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
If you've got a Bible, turn to Matthew 17. Also, if you've got a copy of the bulletin this morning, on the backside of that bulletin is a copy of this morning's text. I've given you three blanks to fill in if you would like. But I'm going to tell you that there's three blanks, but one of the things I always think about when I'm putting together a sermon is, what do I want folks to take away? And there's really two main things that I want you to take away this morning, so I hope you'll be locked in with me to try to grab those two. But I also I'm going to go down a little side road, which might be controversial. So it's worth staying awake for it, okay? This may be my last sermon here at Pleasant View, so it'd be worth staying awake for it. But we are continuing our series on the life of Peter. We're calling this series Simon Says because of Peter's given name being Simon. And so often in the ministry of Jesus, Peter is just simply saying things that you know, could come to his mind in a moment's notice. And this morning is no different than that. With a very simple word begins something that Jesus tries to teach Peter. But we start off in verse 24 of Matthew 17. Now, by the way, the last time we looked at Peter was 2 weeks ago, because last week we did something different for Easter, but we did a series of, I think, four kind of scenes where Peter made some statements, and some of those happened after this, so we're kind of rewinding just a little bit. But it says, when they came to Capernaum, and this is the last time in the Gospels it's recorded that Jesus was with his disciples in the city of Capernaum, and that city was significant because it was the adopted hometown of Jesus. Jesus was from Nazareth, and he had chosen Capernaum as his base of operations for his Galilean ministry. And just as a reminder, we've looked at Capernaum, some slides of Capernaum throughout this series, but Capernaum was not only the hometown of Jesus, it was also the place where Peter lived, along with his family and his mother-in-law. We talked about the healing of Peter's mother-in-law in the city of Capernaum. But the ruins at Capernaum are still there today. We've talked about what they believe that traditionally holds what was Peter's house. We have no idea which one was Peter's house, but tradition holds that was it. But this is the synagogue. We've talked about this. I won't go back and revisit that. We've talked a lot about that in Capernaum. But I wanted to leave you with this image in Capernaum, because at the very end of today's story, it's going to talk about Jesus telling Peter to go and cast a hook. And just a reminder that Capernaum was right on the Sea of Galilee. And when Jesus first encountered Peter, if you remember back to our first lesson, it was Peter, after they had first been introduced, but his first kind of extended interaction with Peter was while Peter was fishing. That was his chosen profession. And Peter, would not have had to gone very far when Jesus told him to cast the hook to get to the Sea of Galilee. So just a reminder about the city of Capernaum. But it says, when they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax. Now, I'm going to stop there for a second, because this tells us quite a bit, actually, about what kind of tax they were trying to collect. The 2 drachma tax was not a Roman tax. In this time, Romans were in charge of Palestine. Palestine was part of the Roman Empire. And Matthew, who's writing this gospel, was, in his previous profession, a Roman tax collector. And by the way, he's the only one that records this conversation, this event, which I think would have been particular interest to him because of his previous profession. But this was not a Roman tax. The 2 drachma tax, also known as the half shekel tax, was a Jewish tax that God instituted while the children of Israel were wandering in the wilderness. If you look on the bottom right on the back of the bulletin, I've got a note about Exodus 30 when this was instituted. When the tabernacle was built, the Jews were commanded to collect this 2 drachma or half shekel tax from every Jewish male who was 20 years old or older in support of the tabernacle. Now, this practice was continued even after the time of the temple, and you can read about in Nehemiah that in Nehemiah's time, when the temple was rebuilt after it was destroyed by the Babylonians, they were collecting a 1/3 shekel from Jewish males to upkeep the temple. But by the time of Jesus, it was back to a 1/2 shekel tax. We don't read about that in Scripture, but we can read about that in extra biblical writings like Josephus, who was a Jewish historian who wrote for the Romans in the late 1st century. We can also read about that in the Mishnah. We talked about the Mishnah on Sunday nights, which was a Jewish, the oral traditions, which were ultimately recorded in writing, that talk about the 1/2 shekel tax. So I went through all of that detail to point out that this was a tax for Jewish men collected by Jewish leaders, like the high priest, the Sanhedrin, for the upkeep of the temple. This was not a Roman tax, okay? This was not a tax paid to the Roman Empire, not a tax paid to Caesar. Now, so the collectors of this 2 drachma tax came up to Peter. And this comes to our first blank, which is pursuit. They were pursuing the tax. And they said, does your teacher, meaning Jesus, not pay the tax? Now, at this point, I don't think Peter had any idea whether Jesus paid the tax or not. I don't know if he knew or not, but he didn't have any idea. And, while it's hard to know what the motivation was for these collectors to be asking the question, I doubt it was an innocent question. There was probably, motivation behind it, trying to trap, Jesus. Hey, your teacher's not supporting the temple. He doesn't love God. He's trying to be a teacher, but he's not supporting us. Whatever it was, I doubt the motivation was pure. But if you look at verse 25, regardless of what Peter did or did not know, what did he say? Yes. Yes. Simon says, right? Boom, comes out of his mouth. Now, why did he say yes? Again, we don't know for certain, but maybe he just didn't know what else to say. Maybe he was trying to protect his teacher or trying to protect himself. But off the cuff, he simply answers yes. And then when he comes back into the house, now we don't know what house this is, but Peter lived in Capernaum, so likely it was his house. So he comes into the house, and who's in there? Jesus. And what does Jesus already know? He already knows the conversation, right? He already knows what they've been talking about, what these tax collectors have asked Peter and what his answer was. He already knows about it, which in and of itself is a demonstration that he is unique, right? That Jesus already knew the conversation. But Jesus uses this as a teaching moment for Peter. You think about, again, 2 weeks ago, we looked at all those different comments, almost all of those. Jesus used them as a teaching opportunity. And he uses this as a teaching opportunity for Peter as well. And he uses it as an opportunity to give Peter some perspective. Okay, really, we're going to spend the rest of this lesson talking about this, the perspective. Okay, the perspective that he gives Peter. We're going to cover it. We're going to read through it quickly, and then I'll come back and talk about those two things that I hope you'll take away that Jesus is trying to teach Peter. So he said yes, came into the house. Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" Now, why did I go through the big explanation at the beginning about what the purpose of this tax was? Because it was for the temple. And the temple was whose house? God's house. Okay? Originally built by Solomon, given approval by God to build by Solomon, rebuilt during the time of when the refugees came back from Babylon, rebuilt again by Herod the Great, you know, just before the first century AD. But it was for God's house. And so Jesus asked Peter a question. You know, in this theoretical kingdom, if a king is collecting taxes, who is he collecting the taxes from? From their sons or from others in the kingdom? It's just a hypothetical. Peter, what do you say? Who has to pay the tax? The sons of the king or the subjects of the king? And Peter, verse 26, said, from others. And Jesus said to him then, here's the conclusion, sons are free. So Jesus is, he's saying a lot in this, but I'll come back to that in just a minute. But he's making a point to say, this is a tax on the upkeep of my father's house. I'm the son. Now Peter knew he was the son. Those who were asking Peter about the tax did not know, likely, that Jesus was the son. May have known that he claimed to be, but doubt that they believed it. But Jesus says, then the sons are free. He's saying, he's echoing what Peter already knows, because Peter, this is after the confession in Matthew 16, when Peter said, you are the Son of God, the Holy One of God, right? And then Caesarea Philippi. And he says, so the sons are free. He's giving Peter some perspective. Like, hey, I'm the son. I have all the rights. I have all the power. By the way, he's already demonstrated the power because he knew what the conversation was. I have all the rights. I have all the power. I have all the authority. I'm free. But that's not the only perspective he gives Peter. Because the very next words he says in verse 27 are, however, not to give offense to them, go to the sea. And then that leads us to the third thing, which is Jesus gives Peter a way to provide to pay the tax, right? He says, go cast a hook, take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Now, the tax was 2 drachma, or half a shekel. Those are the equivalent of each other. So 1 shekel would pay for both. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. He gave him an opportunity. As Steve said, when he led all things bright and beautiful, that God is in control of everything, even the fish, you know, everything, right? He had the power to have a fish that had a shekel in its mouth, right? Okay. So what's the point of all this? Well, there's 2 things I take away that Jesus is trying to teach Peter. And that is that Jesus is the most unique being that has ever existed on this earth. I had no idea that Steve was going to lead the song All Things Bright and Beautiful this morning. But I love that he did. For a number of reasons, not the least of which, or maybe the least of which, because the meaning is much bigger than this, but it meant something to me who wrote that song. That the music of that song was written by Elo Sanderson. Sorry, I'm going to this is not the side road I mentioned earlier. This is a different side road. That music was written by Elo Sanderson. Elo Sanderson was the music editor for Gospel Advocate. I worked for Gospel Advocate for a number of years. And in our, we had a, I don't know if you would call it a museum or an archive of things that were important over the over 150-year history of Gospel Advocate. We had Elo Sanderson's typewriter. Now, that typewriter was built by IBM, and it was a custom typewriter that had on it shape notes. It was a unique, one-of-a-kind typewriter. Not another one made that was like it. And I know I'm reaching a little bit, but Jesus is telling Peter in this, I am a unique, one-of-a-kind being. There is no one who has what I have in this combination. Okay, here's the 2 things that make him the most unique being that has ever existed. Peter is, Jesus is first telling him in that perspective part, let me give this back to you, Charlie, in that perspective part that I am the Son of God. I am absolutely all-powerful, and I have all rights and all authority. How did he demonstrate that? Well, one, he reinforced that he's the son of the king. Okay? Something Peter, one chapter earlier, had already confessed. I'm the son of the king. I have all the rights. I don't have to pay a tax to support my father's house. I mean, Jesus earlier in his ministry had referred to the temple as his father's house. I don't have to pay this. I have that right. He also demonstrated that he knew what the conversation was that took place in another place, right? He demonstrated the power. He also demonstrated the power that Steve referenced when he sang the song, All Things Bright and Beautiful, that he had power over the fish, not just to catch a fish. He'd already demonstrated that with Peter, by the way, in the upper right-hand corner of the bulletin. I've got 6 different miracles that Jesus performed that Peter was involved with. And one of those earlier was a miraculous catch of fish, right? When he first encountered Peter. Well, this is a little different. This is one fish, but one fish with a coin in its mouth. How much power does that demonstrate? Okay, so, big picture. Son of God, all the power, all the rights, all the authority, omniscience on full display. But here's the second part of the perspective. In so many situations, he was willing to lay that down. He was willing to lay that down. Even in this simplistic one where he's making the point that I don't owe this tax, what does he say? However, so as not to cause offense, I'm going to lay down my right. Was not Jesus' entire earthly life a laying down of his rights? I mean, I take from this, Jesus did not have the money to pay the tax. Thus the need for the miracle. Jesus gave up everything to come here. He gave up, as Paul said in Philippians chapter 2, that he allowed himself to be emptied out. What does that mean? What does empty mean? There's nothing left. He gave up all the rights that come with being the son of the Creator so that he could come down here and save us. He could come down here and save us. Now, here's where I'm going to go the side road. Okay, so if you're asleep, you might want to wake up. Okay, here's the side road. I've got a note at the bottom. I'm not going to read this note to you. I'm just going to tell you kind of what it says. There are some who try to paint a picture of Jesus that I believe is incredibly inconsistent with the narrative of Scripture. And that is a narrative of Jesus as a rebel. Specifically, a rebel against governing authorities. And this is one of many places that they will point to and say, well, look, Jesus is saying the sons of God, and therefore Christian, don't have to pay taxes. So why did I make a big deal about this being a temple tax and not a Roman tax? Because there's nothing about this where Jesus is saying you don't have to submit to the Roman Empire. In Matthew 22, what did he say? What did he say when he was asked the question, "Who should we, should we pay taxes to Caesar?" What did he say? Show me the coin. Whose picture's on it? Give to Caesar what Caesar's, give to God what is God. There is nothing in the New Testament about Jesus being a rebel against governing authorities. Everything in Jesus' life is about laying down his rights for the good of others. Okay? Laying down his rights for the good of others. And someone said, well, wait a minute. Didn't he overturn the tables of the money changers? Didn't he fashion a cord and whip them out and drive them out? Those were the, quote, religious leaders. What he fought against was false religion, false followers of God, not against the government. Jesus was not a political revolutionary. He said numerous times, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not here, right? Paul echoes that in Philippians 3. Our citizenship is not here, right? We have citizenship somewhere else. All right, Tim, where are you going with this? I'm going to tie this in with less than 2 weeks ago, too. We've had a lot of tragic things that have happened the last few weeks. From, I think about all those young girls that lost their life on the highway on Interstate 24 a few weeks ago. You got the Covenant shooting, the Covenant school. You got the Louisville. I mean, there was another one yesterday, right? Or this morning. You got all the natural disasters that have happened that folks have lost their lives. The Covenant one, personally, has hit home because my wife works, my girls go to school less than a mile from where that happened. And less than a week after it, there was a threat against their school, and we held our kids out of school because of it. I mean, and I get scared sending to school. So, but with that one specifically, there has definitely been a lot of outpouring of compassion and empathy and support. But there's also been another reaction, specifically from Christians. And I have this love-hate relationship with social media that most of the time is hate. When I see how Christians act on social media. And in response to, again, I'm not discounting that there has been a lot of empathy and a lot of compassion. But there's also been a lot of fighting. Christians posting things publicly. Arguing. Getting angry. Demonstrating hateful things about their rights on both sides of any issue you can come up with. And it hurts me to see that. Because that is not what Jesus demonstrated. That is not what Jesus demonstrated in his ministry when he was here. He gave up everything. And in every situation, he showed compassion, love, empathy. And I was thinking back to, again, the lesson 2 weeks ago, which was four comments that Peter made that Jesus had a response to. One of those was, it came after this, in Matthew 18, where Peter came up to Jesus and said, "Teacher, how many times should I forgive my brother?" You know that statement? And he said, "As many as seven times." And what was Peter looking for? I think he was looking for a pat on the back, an attaboy. Hey, you go, Peter. You are Superman when it comes to forgiving, right? Because the rabbinic consensus said you just got to do it three times. And Peter's looking for, woo, wow, way to go, Peter. And instead, Jesus tells him a story about what? About a king who forgave the servant an unpayable debt. And then that servant went out immediately and demanded a payment from a very small debt from a fellow servant. Right? We know that story. He's trying to teach him a thing about forgiveness. I found out a couple days ago. Again, I've seen all the conflict that people are having in political circles and whatever about, you know, in the wake of the Covenant school shooting. I found out a couple days ago that members of the Covenant Church paid for the funeral of the shooter. Jesus wasn't a political revolutionary. As we studied in 1 John, he was the demonstration of perfect love. And Jesus here is trying to teach Peter a lesson to say, I have all the rights, I have all the power, but I'm willing to give it up for the betterment of others. Jesus gave up everything. And I may have gone a million different directions, but I hope that we come out of here remembering those two things. That Jesus is the ultimate when it comes to power and rights and authority. But he gave up everything for us. Everything. He gave it all up. He gave it all up. The Hebrew writer in Hebrews 4 explained that Jesus he's ascended through heaven. He's sitting at the right hand of God, which I believe is a way of saying he is the ultimate. He is God. But then he says, but he lived through everything that we lived through. Meaning what? He emptied himself, allowed himself to come down here, go through everything we go through. And he says, Because of that, we should have confidence to be able to go to him to ask for grace, to ask for mercy, to help in time of need. Because he is that ultimate, unique, one of a kind, who is now our Savior and our High Priest. Our Savior and our High Priest. I don't know about you, but I need that reminder a lot about the uniqueness of Jesus and what he was willing to give up because he loved us so much. In this morning's class, Jeff talked about the fruits of the Spirit. I had not planned on going this direction, but it brought to mind that kind of side road I just took. And I was thinking about those fruits of the Spirit. You listen, what comes before that, we tend to focus on the fruits of the Spirit, but don't remember that he puts that out there in contrast with the works of the flesh. And in the middle of the works of the flesh, he says there's fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy. Those are works of the flesh. Fruits of the Spirit, we know those, right? Joy, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Our fruits show whether we have God's Spirit. Our fruits show whether we are truly followers of God. And if our lives are full of dissension and anger and rivalries, what does that say about where our allegiance really lies? Are we a reflection of the uniqueness of Jesus and what he was trying to teach Peter? Or are we instead a reflection of the world around us? The only way to have those fruits is to be part of God's kingdom, to be a follower of Jesus. And if you're here this morning and you've never made that decision to follow him, to be buried with him in baptism, we encourage you to think about that this morning. If there's anything else we can do for you, if you need prayers, if you need encouragement, anything we can help you with, please come while Steve leads us in our invitation song.